If you would like a free newsletter on this or other subjects, just give us a call at Christian Answers. The phone number is area code 512-218-8022. That's 512-218-8022. Or you could email us at cdebater@aol.com. That's cdebater@aol.com. Thank you.
The Bible says in 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 3 through 7, first of all, you must understand that in the last days scoffers will come, scoffing and following their own evil desires. They will say, "Where is this coming?" He promised. Ever since our fathers died, everything goes on as it has since the beginning of creation. But they deliberately forget that long ago, by God's word, the heavens existed, and the earth was formed out of the water and by water. By these waters also the world of that time was deluged and destroyed. By the same word, the present heavens and earth are reserved for fire, being kept for the day of judgment and destruction of ungodly men. Greetings, I'm Larry Wessels. I want to thank you for joining us today. This is a joint Research and Education Foundation and Peaceway Productions broadcast, and we will be doing a series here today on creation science versus the mythology of evolution. I'm Larry Wessels, of course, with the Research and Education Foundation, and joining me in this series is my co-host for today's show, the director of Peaceway Productions, Dale Deloney. Dale, it's great to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And, of course, our very special guest, Dr. Michael Gerard from the Institute of Creation Research.
Good to be here.
Yes, it's great to have you here. Doctor, as a point of reference for our viewers, I was wondering if you could maybe give a little background about yourself very briefly and maybe a little bit of information about the Institute for Creation Research, maybe some publications you might have and so forth.
Great. I'm a medical physician from the New Orleans area. I've stepped out of my medical practice now to do apologetics and especially in the area of creation science full time. I'd worked with the Institute for Creation Research for about a 3-year period, participating in the Back to Genesis conferences. Now I do independent work. I'm on my own, but the Institute for Creation Research is an outstanding organization, many good publications, many good books that they carry. They distribute books through the Master Book Company that's affiliated with the Institute for Creation Research. People can write to ICR and get information. They can get placed on their mailing list. They'll receive a monthly publication, Acts and Facts, which will give them a little bit of scientific information about creation from both a technical and a non-technical standpoint. And it's a good way to keep abreast with what's going on in the scientific field.
In fact, I see we have plenty of ICR publications before us. Maybe you'd like to show a few of those
Sure.
to our viewing audience.
This book, Evolution, the Challenge of the Fossil Record, is the book that I first read that right after I'd become a Christian that convinced me that evolution had very, very serious flaws. And as I like to say, I read this book and in about 2 weeks, it destroyed everything I'd been taught about evolution.
Now, it's written by Duane T. Gish.
Dr. Gish, brilliant gentleman, very, very outstanding scientist, a biochemist. It's interesting, a few years ago, Dr. Gish debated an evolutionist at the University of New Orleans And the moderator of the debate at the University of New Orleans, who introduced Dr. Gish, said, I want to just say something right at the very beginning. Lest you think that this gentleman, because he is a creationist, is not a first-rate scientist, I want you to know that in my present research project, I had to go to the library and pull a research article to duplicate some procedures that were performed by Dr. Gish. He said, I am depending upon his science research, he said, and I have the greatest respect for this gentleman, both as a scientist and as a man. Mm-hmm. His book, I've checked his references. It's an outstanding book. I don't want to say it's technical, but it's thorough, but it's an incredible book. Mm-hmm. For people who would like more technical information, the Creation Research Society publishes a magazine. It comes out quarterly, four times a year, and it's outstanding. It really does provide a lot of good information from a technical aspect, and if you write to ICR or write to the Creation Research Society, they can tell you how to get on their mailing list and what to do to become a member of the society. Several thousand creation scientists are now a member of the Creation Research Society. So when people say there are no scientists who are creationists, I just point out the fact that we now are in the number of thousands, several thousands.
You're just talking about men who have a simple bachelor of science.
No, no, no. You, in order to become a member of the Creation Research Society, you have to have an undergraduate degree in science, preferably a graduate degree. And most of those scientists who are members of the Creation Research Society do have either a master's or a doctorate degree in a physical science.
Yeah, many PhDs involved.
Many PhDs.
Oh, excellent. I'd like to say also, just here in the introduction, there's many other books. Of course, this is almost the same thing. Again, there's Dr. Gish's book, Evolution, The Fossils Say No. We have Henry Morris's outstanding book here on scientific creationism. It doesn't really have a cover here, but it's an outstanding book. Also, Ken Ham has a book called The Lie, Evolution, which I think is very good. And there's just a wealth. There's the Answers book. As Dr. Girard was saying, people can call or write, and we'll be glad to put you in touch with the Institute for Creation Research, a wealth of good scientific data, material. In fact, Doctor, would you say that much of this research, scientific data, is basically being suppressed today? I mean, you really don't hear much about this, particularly in the public schools.
It's incredible to say that information is being censored out of the textbooks, off the television, being censored out of college classrooms, high school classrooms, but that's absolutely true. I believe that there's enough evidence to overwhelmingly overthrow the myth of evolution, and yet, when I sit down and I talk with especially college students, even at a graduate level, they are very, very unfamiliar with the data. And that's why I encourage college kids, hey, get some of this information. The information's available, it's there, but most of them aren't aware of it. And it's a very, very frightening thing to see that in America, where we prize liberty and freedom of information and a free exchange of ideas so much of this information is censored. I was speaking last week with the Campus Crusade for Christ. It was 90 college students from LSU in Baton Rouge, and it was incredible to see these students come up, several of them in the graduate program at LSU, and say, Dr. Girard, I've never, ever seen this information. I've never been taught this. And it was amazing to me. You couldn't function as a medical physician that way. I'm amazed that at a college level, the suppression and the censorship is so overwhelming that the information just doesn't get in the textbooks.
Well, basically it's because in public education, you're looked at as some kind of religious fanatic if you deny this theory of evolution and you assert that we got here some other way besides evolution. Is that correct?
I believe that's exactly what it is. And we have to remember that evolution is actually a religion. Sir Karl Popper has been called the greatest philosopher of science who ever lived. Popper said that evolution, he called it Darwinism, was a metaphysical research program. He said it's important to realize that evolution is not a scientific fact, that it is metaphysical, and he emphasized that. Well, metaphysics is more closely allied to religion than it is to anything else. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, if evolution is truly a religion, then as we know from speaking to people who are religious, irregardless of what fact comes up, these people have their prejudice, they have their religious belief, And especially in the case of the evolutionists, they are unwilling to acknowledge that there is overwhelming evidence to overturn not their science, but their belief system. And that's what it is. Evolution fails to meet the definition of science. Science deals with repeatable, observable phenomena that occur in the present. History deals with non-repeatable past events for which there is an eyewitness who reports that. If it's not science and it's not history, then it only leaves belief. And again, Popper is not a Christian. He's not a creationist. He is an evolutionist. And he calls evolution a metaphysical research program.
And I think there was another scientist, I can't remember his name right now, maybe you would know, I think he had something to do with the French encyclopedia. He said something to the effect that evolution is a fairy tale.
Professor Louis Baron, he's been called one of the greatest scientists that France ever produced. He said, evolutionism is a fairy tale for grown-ups. This theory has helped nothing in the progress of science. It is useless, unquote. And Baron is considered the second greatest scientist that France has ever produced, next to Louis Pasteur, who himself was both a Christian and a creationist.
I see. Very good. And, well, with that said, Doctor, I think I want to give Dale a moment here to throw in something as we get ready to move through this to hopefully show our viewing audience that, you know, we're not just a bunch of religious bigots up here that want to believe in fairy tales ourselves, but hopefully there's some verifiable data that can be reasonably looked at, and we will try to present that today in hopes that people will get the other side of the picture that I think they never get in public schools, as you were just saying, because it's almost a form of censorship and brainwashing. Brainwashing, I think, by classic definition, is presenting only one side of the argument and suppressing all other information that may refute that argument. So, Dale, what do you have to interject here?
Well, first of all, I just have to agree with you that it's very biased. Our school systems are humanistic in origin. John Dewey was a humanist and was one of the founders of our public school systems. And what a humanist does, he's an atheist, and that really deifies man. When you take God out of the picture, you deify man. And what they are basically, since you can't prove a universal negative, they can't prove there's no God, so they're really God haters. And the best way to get back at God is to explain him away. Now, they had their theory of evolution, which, you know, sounded real good. In fact, Darwin's bulldog, Thomas Huxley, he even admitted that they wanted to push evolution so that they could live out their immorality. They didn't want to have God's rules on it. And I think when you come right down to it, the reason that, the Bible says we're all sinners. We're all rebellious against God. And this is why God sent his son, Jesus Christ, into the world to reconcile that relationship with him. Now, man loves his sin, and we don't want any authority telling us what to do. So we want to have this explanation. And Jesus said in John 3:19, they love the darkness rather than the light. And they don't come to the light lest their deeds be exposed. So what's the best way of not coming to the light? It's to explain it away. And Thomas Huxley even admitted that evolution was the mechanism by which they could live their immoral lifestyles. So we see that's the real reason, the bottom line reason is the rebellious heart of man. But what really confounds me is that evolution has been totally refuted in every area. I mean, it's like a puzzle you're trying to put together, and the pieces don't fit. And so you just tape them on. You just tape it on, and you know, you try to cut it out and put it on there, and it's got to fit. It's got to fit, and there's this whole lump over here. We just won't look at that, and you know, all this stuff, and it's just a big mess. And so we're going to show you. We're just going to refute evolution, and not just refute evolution, but we're also going to give the case for creation, the case that the God of the Bible has already given to us. And that you can trust the Bible, and you can trust what God says. And evolution falls flat on its face. Matter of fact, the evidence is used in the trial, the Arkansas trial, to get creation, get evolution in the schools. Those evidences have been all refuted now. They're all some. One of them was a hoax, and the rest of them have all been taken care of. You'd like to comment
on trial
that?
Are you talking about?
The Scopes trial.
The
Scopes trial.
1929,
right.
I think it was,
right.
Or somewhere.
1925 Scopes
25,
trial.
25.
It's interesting, back home in the textbooks, I had a radio debate one time with an evolutionist, and in the textbooks that are used in the Orleans Parish School, they listed five proofs of evolution. And I asked this professor, I said, these are the five proofs of evolution that are listed in this high school textbook. I said, now be honest, do you agree with any of them? And he said, well, no, absolutely not. He said, maybe the last one. He said, but I agree with none of them. And I said, well, then explain something to me. What are they doing in a textbook? He said, well, you have to understand, scientists don't write textbooks. I said, who writes them, janitors? That's nonsense. And it's pretty ridiculous when you get that kind of an answer from a PhD, from a very educated, very learned man. Mm-hmm. Larry, I just wanted to point out something on your chart. This is interesting. I became a Christian because of Bible prophecy. I wasn't looking for God or religion or anything else. I was a good scientist, and I had to admit that the prophecies in the Bible mathematically showed that the Bible was supernatural, that it was not a book written by man, as I had always been taught, but that it was a book written from a supernatural source. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that Peter gives four prophecies in the latter days that people will ignore or question the second coming of Christ. That's one. The second thing that they'll question is the age of the earth, believing in uniformitarianism, that all things have happened as they have from the very beginning of time. The third thing that they're going to question is whether or not God made the earth just like he said. In other words, Peter says, and the Bible says, that God created it with a big splash in the water and out of the water, not a big bang. That'll be the third thing they question. And the fourth thing they'll question is a worldwide flood. Out of these four things that scoffers in the last days will question, three out of four deal with creation science. And mm-hmm. those are the areas that we're constantly challenged on. One, what's the age of the earth? Two, what's your evidence for creation? How do you deal with evolution? And three, what's your evidence for a worldwide flood?
Very well stated. And with that, I'd like to go to the next chart, as a matter of fact. Well, I think what's really relevant to this, and it ties in what you were just saying about the supernatural aspect of the Word of God, Genesis 1:1. People out there usually, as you were just saying, take Genesis as kind of a book written by men, and if they do give it any credence at all, they say, well, it was just symbolic, and it's just a Jewish cultural tradition. But let's take a look here at Genesis 1:1. It says, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And I think, Doctor, this is what it really comes down to between creation and evolution. Did God do it, or did it happen some other way, by chance or whatever it is? And of course, as we stay in the scripture here, it says over in the New Testament, Colossians chapter 1, verses 16 and 17, for by him, it's talking about God, or more specifically, Jesus Christ, were all things created that are in heaven and that are in earth, visible and invisible. All things were created by him and for him, and he is before all things, and by him all things consist. So here we have the scriptures very plainly telling us that in the beginning God did it. And then in the New Testament we're told that everything was created by him and for him. So there's a definite purpose to creation, a reason why we're here. And I think this is what the crux of the whole matter is. If evolution is not true, and it's proven to be false by the evidence, then there must be another explanation. And maybe, just maybe, there's a purpose why we're here right now. While you're out there sitting where you are or wherever, and we're here, we're not just some mindless accident, some little cog in a wheel that's expanding through the universe. And with that, I'd like to bring up yet another chart, and we're going to really start getting into it. Oh, did you want to say one thing?
I just wanted to make a comment on this. So many times when I share the gospel with people, they will look at me and they will say, well, Dr. Gerard, I don't believe in the creation of the earth. I believe in a Big Bang explosion. I believe in evolution, ape men. I don't believe there was a worldwide flood. And they always throw in this point that if the Bible lies in the very first verse, how can you trust any of the rest of it? And that is a legitimate point. And that is the basis for so many people rejecting everything past the first sentence in the Bible mm-hmm. all the way through. And there's no reason whatsoever why they should be allowed to reject that when there is substantial scientific evidence to indicate that in the beginning God did create. No question about it. The other implication from this is that if God created, who owns everything? God does. Who am I responsible to? Not myself, but to God. And that makes it totally different. It means that I am not an island. I am not the captain of my own fate. I must obey the laws that God has set for his universe. I am a guest in his house. Mm-hmm. Now, when I create my universe, I get to set the rules. Until then, I need to be obedient to the Creator who is responsible for me being here and whom I am responsible to obey.
And you are not doing this as an act of blind faith, a leap in the dark.
I couldn't do it that way.
This is based on evidence that suits not only your heart but your mind.
Absolutely.
Where they work in conjunction and not against each other.
Right.
Very well. Well, let's go to this next chart I was just mentioning on the other side here. And then I want to set this up before we really get into all the evidences and have you, Doctor, mention some of these things, because I think a lot of people aren't trained in really thinking. They're not thinking about really what's going on. They go to school and they get all the stuff in school, and they're, like we were mentioning, brainwashed, and they just accept things. They don't stop and think about logical consequences and things going on around them. But, Doctor, I have four possible explanations for the existence of the universe, which I always like people to get their ticker going here. And I want to run through these just briefly and then have you expound a little bit on it. But it starts off here at the top. If something exists now, something has always existed.
Cause and effect.
Exactly.
It all had to come from someplace. What's that first cause? Even a four-year-old child can understand that, because they'll keep asking you, well, where did that come from? Well, where did that come from? Well, where did that come from? And they keep regressing. They understand that. So that's a reasonable, logical statement that appeals to everyone's intellect and common sense.
Yes, yes, very, very well stated. Now, here we go. Four possible explanations for what we see around us. One, and I'll state it, and then, Doctor, I want you to comment. The first one, that which seems to exist is an illusion. Actually, nothing exists.
That's an interesting statement. That's what pantheists and panentheists believe. But unfortunately, you can't live consistently with that. Any truth system must be a system that you can live consistently with. And to say that nothing exists is not something that I can live consistently with. Number one, when we leave today, we'll go through the door and not through the wall. If nothing existed, there would be no reason to go through the wall. We could go through the wall. The point being is that pantheism and panentheism is not a system that I can live consistently with. It does not agree with my experience and observation. I experience real things. Historically, people have left written records of events that occur over hundreds and thousands of years that they have observed consistently. So there appears, for all intents and purposes, to be a true reality, and that's the only way that I can live, consistent with the concept that there is a materialistic world that I am functioning in and that I can perceive truthfully.
Right. That's very well stated. You have to live within the reality you find yourself, and this obviously doesn't work with that reality. Okay. Well, I think we can throw out number one. Let's try number two. Something does exist. That which exists is self-existent and eternal.
Well, that would also include me. I'm not eternal. I had a definite beginning, and I'm not self-existing. And we look at so many systems around us right now that are not self-existing.
What about the rocks?
The rocks themselves had to have an origin.
The sun.
The sun itself had to have an origin. We know, based upon our belief, whichever theory you want to look at, a nuclear burning or a gravitational collapse, that had to have a definite beginning also. This idea of being self-existent just doesn't wash. Again, it disagrees with observation.
Does this tie in with quasars and novas, supernovas, where stars are burning out, they're giving off energy and ceasing to exist?
And again, and now we're going to jump to the science real quick, but that's all we really ever observed. We have never observed a star form. We have scientists say, well, we observe gas clouds that we think in the next million or so years would form a star. We still have not seen a star form, but we've seen many stars burn out. Things get old, they expire. If they were self-existent, they would go on forever.
That's right. Well, I think we can eliminate number two. How about number three now? I hope the people out there are thinking here and paying attention.
Let me make
yes.
a comment
Go
on
ahead,
that.
Dan.
Also, you touched on the second law of thermodynamics, which says that everything is wearing out, that everything is
moving towards
entropy, heat death. And that's what we see in our universe. Now, if it's dying out, it had to have a beginning place from which it started. Now, the scientific community would say it's the Big Bang. But what we see in reality, we don't see explosions causing order and design. An explosion in a print shop doesn't make a dictionary. And that would have to be comparable to what we see in the universe. The Big Bang explosion would not create the order that we have now. They have no explanations of how stars are formed. But the point I'm making is the universe is winding down from a beginning. Where there's a beginning, there's a beginner. And who is that beginner? That's God. And that goes against evolution. It goes against what science is saying, but it goes with the Bible. The Bible says, and you can look this up, in Psalms 102, verse 26, 25 and 26, it says that, "Of old thou didst form the earth, and the heavens are the work of thy hands. Even they will perish, but thou dost endure, and all of them will wear out like a garment." And that's what we see, is the earth is waxing old like a garment. The sun is burning out, the stars are burning out, everything's winding down. And the Bible goes exactly with what we see in reality.
Very, very well said. Okay, well, with that, I think we can definitely eliminate number two as a possibility. There's only two left here. Let's see what we can come up with. Number three, that which exists is self-created and eternal.
Again, I'm not self-created. I am not eternal. What we observe is not self-created. That falls on a scientific basis, too, because we never see anything create itself. We never see anything come about spontaneously, spontaneous generation, if you will. Especially life forms must come from pre-existing life. The work of Louis Pasteur.
Cause and effect again.
Exactly. And and all of these come back to that whole concept of cause and effect in the first cause. That's really the bottom line issue. For that same reason, we can reject this.
And point three, again, it also is philosophically absurd, because how can something create itself? It would have to exist, as you just stated, before it created itself.
So it's a logical contradiction.
Exactly. Totally absurd. So I think number three falls flat on its face. Now let's try number four, and I think Dale touched on this already a little bit. That which exists has been created by something that is self-existent and eternal.
Exactly. A creation separate from the Creator, totally apart, with the Creator as that first cause. Where did that come from? Where did that come from? Until you back up to God, and you say, well, where did God come from? And God answers that question, and that's the right person to ask. God says, I didn't come from anywhere. I am self-existing. I am who am. And again, back to Moses, when Moses asked God his name, Moses had been educated in the best schools in Egypt, and Moses had talked about, I'm sure he had been taught a lot of Egyptian philosophy. Moses asked God what his name was, and God said, Moses, I'm going to answer that fundamental question in every philosophical system. I am who am. I am the self-existing one. I didn't come from any place. I have always existed. I am the self-existing one. I am who am. And it's very, very satisfying from a philosophical standpoint, and it does agree with what we can understand to be logically, rationally true. There must ultimately be a first cause.
That's
an
right.
uncaused person, an uncaused event.
Even I know from my studies in philosophy that John Stuart Mill and David Hume came to their tragic conclusions that there must be something out there that we can't observe, because the observable universe is all contingent. It's and so, as you were just stating, even those men, who of course were not Christians by any stretch of the imaginations, came to that kind of conclusion, that there must be something out there. Of course, they didn't prefer to call it God. that must be causing the rest of this stuff to be here. So I thought that was kind of interesting. But it ties in perfectly with what you just said.
Also, I just like to say the other day I was talking to this girl, and I was talking about, it was an operator. I was trying to get a number of a creation science organization. And she says, "What is that?" And I said, "Well, they study creation evidences, and they debate evolutionists and blow them away, basically." And she goes, "Well, I just think the fact that the heavens and earth could be made in 7 days is a bunch of baloney." I said, "Well, let's look at it this way." And this is an operator, but we got into a good conversation. I said, whether you want to say millions and zillions of years or 5 minutes, you have to admit for matter to come out of nothing is a supernatural event. I mean, how does matter come out of nothing? And it had to. And she was, "Well, I don't know. I guess that would have to be a supernatural event." Well, if it's a supernatural event, then God did it, because God's the only one that could do such a thing, then you don't need that time. God can do it in 5 seconds. He could do it in 5 minutes. He said he did it in 7 days, and he did. You could do a zillion years. It doesn't make any difference with the fact of creation out of nothing. And once I said that to her, her eyes were open. And then I gave her some young earth evidences and told her about design and information, and she was hooked. And she said she was going to call the place and find out more information.
Well, so, there you go, Dale, making people think again.
Can I just throw something out? So many people don't understand this concept of epistemology, the philosophy of how do we know what we know, and are unable to separate science from history. When we're dealing with historical events, we're not dealing with something that science can prove. Back to Karl Popper, called the greatest philosopher of science who ever lived, himself an evolutionist. Karl Popper made the statement definitely. He said, "Science can never prove history. Science can comment on history, but science cannot prove history." If we're going to know how everything came into being in the past, then we need an eyewitness who was there right at the beginning. And that's exactly what God says. God says, "I not only saw it, I did it." And God claims to be the perfect eyewitness. God says he cannot lie. God is that eyewitness that you want to bring into court. "I wasn't there." The right question to always ask when people tell you about things that happened in the past is the same question that God asked Job. Were you there? And when we deal with past events, with historical events, that's the right question to ask a scientist or an archaeologist or an historian. Were you there? The most important evidence comes from that eyewitness who was there, who can give us truthful testimony about the events that occurred. That's the way we determine historical facts. That's the way we determine things historically. And your operator wasn't there. I wasn't there. Carl Sagan wasn't there. Isaac Asimov wasn't there. They really don't know. They can speculate, but their speculation is no better than mine. The truth of the matter is that the God of the universe, who says that he did it, was there, saw it, and claims to communicate truthfully and in such a way that we can know that his communication is supernatural. Not the word of man, but the word of God. And that's the challenge to everyone. The evidence to prove that is so overwhelming that if we miss it, we've missed the single most communication in the world.
Right.
Now we've got all these, we've gotten into this philosophical discussion, but we've got to back up what we say with facts. So
let's
get into the evidence.
Let's move on to the next chart then. And what do you know it? I've got the chart backwards. Let me just flip it to side one here, and we'll start moving down. What we have now for our viewers is a bunch of commonly asked questions. We're going to let Dr. Gerard really get into a lot of this creation science we've been talking so much about. We're going to bring up, I think, valid and pertinent questions concerning this whole creation evolution controversy. And we're going to try to let the facts speak for themselves. Now, it must be pointed out at this point that the evolutionist and the creation scientists both have the same set of evidences. They're both looking at this. We have just the one world. The evolutionist looks at the Grand Canyon, and the creationist looks at the Grand Canyon. They both see the same canyon, but they come to different conclusions. The question to ask, and to use your mind and think, is what explanation is more reasonable? I mean, of course we can't on this show you know, have God come down in the clouds and show He's here for you. What we can do is present in a rational, common sense type of way what explanations are more reasonable or fit the facts better. And that's what we're going to try to do.
And fill in the gaps. Nobody ever has all the evidence or information, but I will propose mm-hmm. this. Those of us who have gone through public and even Christian education have had much of the evidence censored. So yes. What we want to do today is just present the evidence and let people make a decision. Don't censor it out. Let's talk about what's really there and let folks make that come to their own conclusion.
In fact, Doctor, you just mentioned a point that just struck a nerve with me. I think that the theory of evolution now is taught, as you just mentioned, not only in public schools, but in many seminaries where men are learning to be pastors of churches. It's taught by many world religions.
It's taught in conservative seminaries, and it's taught in conservative Christian schools. And I would challenge parents who have children in Christian schools, pick up their textbooks, look at what they're being taught. I think it might surprise you. Because it does make a big image when you tell a teenager that they're made in the image of an ape versus being made in the image of a man. Because teenagers can think, and they do think. They will sit down there and they'll reason, well, if I'm made in the image of an animal, I should act like an animal. And it presents a very, very bad picture. If evolution is true, then survival of the fittest is the most important thing. Well, if I'm not the most handsome, most intelligent, most athletic, most beautiful, what value and worth do I have? Why should I go on living? And it's that type of thinking that produces a suicide rate in teenagers that's alarming. That's why suicide is the second leading cause of death in teenagers. Mm-hmm. If they are made in the image of an ape, they came from an ape, that came from a big bang, that came from nothing, they came from nothing, they're going nowhere.
Doctor, I think in your own field of medicine, you've dealt with maybe teenage suicides.
Tremendous number.
Do you have any particular one?
The reasoning I just gave you comes from a teenager.
So you've experienced
yes.
this in real life.
Absolutely.
Teenage suicide.
It makes so much of a difference when you tell somebody you're made in the image of the infinite, personal, loving creator of the universe who thought so much of you that he would come down as a man and offer his life for you just so that mm-hmm. you could spend eternity with him. Mm-hmm. Versus telling them, you made the image of an animal, act like an animal, it doesn't mm-hmm. matter. And if you can't achieve the greatness that you see on television or the beauty that you see on television, then you are less of a person. Mm-hmm. You are less of a highly evolved form of animal. What Christianity tells me is that I'm made in the image of God, not based upon what I do, but based upon whose image I'm made in. I am special, I am unique, and I am loved by that God.
Very well said. This brings me to the point, as we get ready now to go to the chart, I just wanted to bring up one last point, that evolution is a religion,
yes.
and it was started by a man who wrote The Origin of the Species, Charles Darwin, in I think 1859, and just as a quick reference, what were his scientific credentials for coming up with this theory of so-called science that has been accepted by scientists all over the world now? What were his scientific credentials?
He had studied in college medicine for a very brief period, mm-hmm. and he then went to a seminary to study theology.
A seminary.
And he read a lot of books, and that was his basic background in science.
Mainly,
not much.
More of a theology background.
Exactly right.
And I just thought that'd be interesting for people to know that the theory of evolution, its greatest proponent, had a theology background.
In fairness to Darwin, let me say this. Charles Darwin was a good observer. Charles mm-hmm. Darwin made some very good observations, mm-hmm. but he did not have the technical background to be a scientist. And much of what he observed, he accurately recorded. It was his interpretations that showed his deficiency in the natural sciences.
And that's where it brings us back to the point I made before, looking at the evidence.
Exactly right.
And then interpreting what that evidence says.
I'd just like to make a comment before we go to the chart. I've got here children's books. And, you know, we teach kids, small children in our public schools that they are an accident from chemicals and that they came from an ape and then became cavemen, and basically teach them how to love Mother Earth and save the planet and all this. And when you tell them that they are an accident and they are an animal, and then should you wonder that our schools are zoos now? And it's a very destructive philosophy, and it all comes down to to that humanism, you know, that rebellion against God element. But the thing is, as we're going to show you, evolution does not have any facts. The facts are distorted, they're covered up, the truth is suppressed, and I'm angry. I am angry that this stuff is forced on small children and indoctrinated, brainwashed on all of us through high school and college. We didn't sign up for evolution, the theory. It was told to us as fact. It was forced on us. They've taken God out of the schools, they took creation science out of the schools, and now you are forced to be brainwashed and indoctrinated with evolution, telling you all this ridiculous stuff. It has no explanation for where information design comes from. It tells you that soil grew upward, and does that explain, like, fossils, you know? And the flood's just a myth. There's a book on myths that says the flood is a myth because every civilization has a legend of a flood. Now, that's proof of a flood. Did they all come up with the same fairy tale? You know, give me a break. And this is the kind of stuff that is pushed down our throats as fact. And then the creation scientist comes along, or maybe an evolutionist that all of a sudden sees the light and becomes a creation scientist, and he's thrown out of the university. They even try to take away their credentials sometimes. So there's quite a biased thing going on, and it's just, I mean, people really need to rise up and do something about it, which is one of the reasons we're doing this show right now.
All right. Well, that said, let's go to our long-awaited chart here. We're going to start, hopefully, in a rapid-fire way. Answer as many of these. Of course, this is a series, folks. This is the first installment of a series of programs on this topic. So in today's show, we'll definitely not get through all the points. So you'll have to tune in next time to pick up where we left off. And as we continue through these fascinating questions pertaining to origins, and I hope that what you'll be hearing here will be truly exciting for you, and that you'll definitely contact the Institute for Creation Research or send Dr. Gerard a letter. You can mail it to our ministries. The phone numbers and mailing addresses are on the show and at the end of the show. So feel free to contact us, and we'll see that Dr. Gerard gets any information, and also the Institute of Creation Research, which will have their address too at the end of the program. So with that said, let's move to the chart. As we get into all these points we want to bring up and have Dr. Gerard talk about, I just wanted to mention with this Askaris here, the word science. Dr. Gerard's already mentioned something about it already in the program. The question is, what is it? And I just wanted to bring up the fact that in science, a lot of times there's these, in the question of evolution, there's a lot of preconceived ideas and presuppositions that you have to deal with in this whole controversy. Something falsely called science could be nothing more than a scientist's preconceived ideas or his presuppositions. Could you talk a little bit about what is science, and then how should the average person out there look out for these preconceived ideas that scientists usually force into their interpretation of data?
And I'll give an example. Science is that body of knowledge that we gather by using the scientific method. In science, we deal with repeatable, observable events, and because they're repeatable, they have to occur in the present. So for science to be science, we deal with repeatable events that occur in the present that are observable. When we deal with past events, like the Big Bang explosion, it's not science. When we deal with non-observable events, like the Big Bang explosion, it's not science. When we deal with non-repeatable events, like the Big Bang explosion, it's not science. That might be a prejudice. That's a belief. Now, again, some people, and I've had different folks argue and say, well, listen, the Big Bang, or evolution in any aspect, occurred in the past, and it's non-repeatable, and therefore it's history. History does occur in the past. It is non-repeatable. However, history requires an eyewitness. And there was no eyewitness for any aspect of evolution. And that we have to remember, that evolution fails the test of science. It fails the test of history. It becomes a belief system. But what about the preconceived ideas and the prejudices? Everyone who does anything, scientist, lawyer, physician, whatever, enters their pursuit with a preconceived idea and a prejudice. We try very, very hard to get rid of that preconceived idea, to get rid of that prejudice, but there's always a bias in what everyone does. The question is, when we report scientifically certain things, are we reporting the data or our prejudice? Most of the times when we pick up a newspaper article or when we pick up a magazine article, we are not reading about experimental data or observed phenomena. What we're reading about is one man's interpretation of the data. That interpretation will contain his prejudice. And that's been seen most notably in this whole area of evolution, particularly in the area that deals with ape men, particularly in the area that deals with astrophysics and astronomical observations. Most of the things that are reported are not directly observed. What is directly observed are certain patterns of spectral lines, etc., electromagnetic phenomena. But that's reported as if we see, and I'll give one example, a star forming. So many times in the past years, we've had newspaper headlines, scientists observe star formation. When that is not occurring at all, what is being observed is that a large cloud of gases is seen in one area. Well, that could be the remnant of a star that exploded. That could just be a conglomeration of gases that first became visible. But what we do get reported is the interpretation, which does not necessarily fit the data, and that's where the prejudice comes in. Let me state this also. Whenever you see a prejudice, whenever you see a scientist who's working in a college or a university, if he does not obey the party line and state what they want him to state, his job is in jeopardy. Can I quote to you from an article in Scientific America?
Now, that sounds like political correctness.
That's exactly what it comes down to.
So there's and PC and science, huh?
Exactly right.
Well, that's where it leads. It leads to that. When you take God out of the picture, you're left with finite, immoral, you know, human beings. And it's all going to lead to the same type of thought. Mm-hmm. The thought is going to have to be very liberal and very immoral, and which is PC.
Well, I know also the great writer from Oxford University, C.S. Lewis. He was fearful of losing his position at the university, so he never came right out with his creationist perspective. Mm-hmm. So what he did was, in his Chronicles of Narnia, he mentioned it as an allegory so that they couldn't nail him, because he had to be careful in his what he stated for fear of losing his professorship at Oxford University.
Incredible.
It's amazing when you have to do that in allegory through one of your novels to get your creationist view out. But anyway, have you found the article here?
I found the article. This is from Scientific American, February 1992. It's an article written by Jeffrey Burbridge, professor of physics at the University of California, San Diego, former director of the Kitt Peak National Observatory, page 120. He talks about Big Bang cosmology, and in this article entitled, Why Only One Big Bang, he makes these statements. Big Bang cosmology is probably as widely believed as has been any theory of the universe in the history of Western civilization. It rests, however, on many untested and, in some cases, untestable assumptions. Indeed, Big Bang cosmology has become a bandwagon of thought that reflects faith as much as objective truth. He goes on to say, those of us who have been around long enough know that peer review and the refereeing of papers have become a form of censorship. This man is an evolutionist now. He's not a creationist stating this. It is extraordinarily difficult to get financial support or viewing time on a telescope unless one writes a proposal that follows the party line. A few years back, Halton C. Arp was denied telescope time at Mount Wilson and Palomar observatories because his observing program had found and continued to find evidence contrary to standard cosmology. And then he goes on to say there are good reasons to think the Big Bang model is seriously flawed. He states that none of these ideas can be directly tested, and he concludes by saying the Big Bang ultimately reflects some cosmologist's search for creation and for a beginning. That search properly lies in the realm of metaphysics, not science. It's interesting that he talks about the pressure that was put on one particular scientist because he didn't cling to the party line. He was denied access to the scientific instruments that would disprove this particular theory of the Big Bang. Well, that's not good science. What would have happened if, when Louis Pasteur was promoting his concept of the germ theory for disease, if people had said, well, Louis, we don't agree with what you're saying. We're not going to give you access to microscopes and money, research dollars. Well, where would we be today? Where would medicine be?
Right.
That's not good science. And he calls it, Burbage calls it censorship.
Yeah, but there's someone that would respond to that and say, well, I read a newspaper article a while back that said that they proved the Big Bang because there was some kind of minute variation in some meter thing that some astronomer was. Have you heard of that?
The COBE satellite data. The problem with the COBE satellite data is that, and it's admitted by Smoot, the researcher who's looking at the data, he says, we don't know which points are real and which points are noise. And the precision of the instrument, ends several decimal places before the observed phenomena, which means that they're trying to pick things that are basically noise and calling it true data. They are desperate to find any fluctuation in the microwave background radiation, which is what they were experimenting with, because if there is a smooth cosmic microwave background radiation, it is, in effect, a formal disproof of the Big Bang theory. This is their last hope, and if this is the best that they can find, then it's no proof whatsoever.
And this is interesting because the evidence is just virtually, from what I've seen, flimsy at best, and really not even that good. And the national news media all around the world, everybody jumps on this and puts it on the front page of the newspapers.
April 1992, this, quote, fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background radiation from the COBE satellite made front page color headlines of USA Today. Mm-hmm. A year later, many scientists have now come out and said, wait a minute, your instruments cannot measure with that degree of precision. You can't tell what's noise and what's not. And it still wouldn't prove the Big Bang because you need a much greater fluctuation to account for all the structures in the universe.
You know, and then whenever they put the refutation of those articles, it's always in the back, little article in the back of the paper.
Section H, page 59.
You know, but I want to just comment on the bias. I had a curator of a museum called me up from seeing our evolution shows. It said there was no missing links in any of the chain. He says, no, there's missing links. And we talked for 2 hours, and I answered every one of his questions, refuted. We talked about the hoaxes. I explained that the missing links are still missing. We talked about design, and information. And we got all the way down to it, and he couldn't answer anything I told him, and I answered everything he said. And I said, okay, bottom line, how would a human come from an ape? And this guy is claiming to be a scientist, and all his best friends are the top scientists in the world. And he said a gamma ray could have hit a pregnant ape in her womb and created a man. I mean, you talk about not admitting to the facts and being so biased, you come up with a ludicrous, I guess we call that the Hulk theory or something, you know. But then what you would have to have the male and the female.
Twins.
Twins would do it. And, it was just ridiculous.
We don't have enough faith. That's your problem.
Well, see, the whole thing is on faith.
It just shows you that the world rushes to find anything but God. The minute you are forced to admit that there may be a creator, then you're forced to the same conclusion that you're responsible for that creator.
Right.
And that's what men do not want. And they'll look anywhere but to, I think, the truth of the matter. But now we're almost out of time, but we have time to get into one of these briefly, and then hopefully that'll set you up for next time we have our show, and we'll continue on this chart. Okay, Doctor, if we could have your comments here. We have point number one. What about the pillars of the universe, which I've heard Dr. A.E. Wildersmith say are matter, energy, and information? And basically, to follow this question up, does matter produce information? Does time create information? And just give us a general broad view of this whole situation here.
Let me just say this. Does matter produce information? The answer is absolutely not. There's some good books written on that, and I guess the best one was a book written by Thaxton, Bradley, and Olson, some chemical engineers. Dr. Bradley, I believe, is at Texas A&M, and they look at the experimental evidence to see if you can get, especially this one, information from non-information. If matter by itself has enough information to form DNA and RNA, the informational molecules that make up every living system.
Okay, so that's the definition that the viewers at home are wondering about. When we say information, are we talking about
information in a biological system, we mean usable information. We don't mean information as it applies to information theory as the physicist understands it. We mean usable information that can go to direct processes and be used to replicate organisms, to do serious beneficial functions that promote life, that maintain life, that sustain life. We just don't mean throwing a bunch of amino acids into a system. A physicist would look at that from the a concept of information theory and call that information. We're talking about usable information, and that's very, very important. Somebody wants to go through the mathematical derivations of these things. Brillouin, Schrodinger, Dr. Yockey has done extensive work on that. Thaxton, Bradley, and Olson take it and put it in a simplistic view, look at the experimental evidence, and in their excellent book, The Mystery of Life's Origin, conclude you could never, ever get information from matter. But I know we're almost out of time, and this is
right.
Something really important. I want to take up on that a little bit later.
In fact, with our time running now, we have about a minute left in the program. We will continue. We're going to get into all kinds of fascinating information, fossils and thermodynamics and microevolution, all these different questions, though. Dinosaurs, I know everybody wants to know about that, especially in light of Jurassic Park. But with the time running out on us, gentlemen, I would like each of you to give maybe a 30-second comment here to the viewers at home about this whole thing in a quick summation. And then we'll sign off the show.
I would just ask the viewers at home to ask yourself this question. Is evolution possibly a myth? Could it just be a propaganda ploy that's being promoted? And if so, what evidence would you accept to prove it? Second thing I would ask them to consider, have you ever asked an evolutionary scientist this question? What evidence or evidences would be significant and substantial enough to disprove evolution? That's the most important question.
Very good. Dale, final comments.
I would like to comment on the information. The DNA code, the DNA itself has tons and tons of coded information. And there's no natural science that explains where information came from. If you find a watch in the desert, you don't say it just happened. There's a watchmaker, an intelligent designer. The faces on Mount Rushmore. Carl Sagan said if we got one message from outer space, that would prove that there's intelligent people on other planets. Well, we've got tons of information around us that proves that there's an intelligent designer, an intelligent creator. And I would just like to point you to the Bible that in the very...
All right. Time's about up here, Dale.
Okay.
I'd like to thank you all for joining us today. I'm Larry Wessels with Dale Deloney and Dr. Michael Gerard from the Institute for Creation Research. Join us next time when we'll pick up this subject again. If you need a call or write, the numbers are at the end of the show. God bless you.
Check out our websites, BibleQuery.org. This site answers 7,700 Bible questions. HistoryCart.com. This site reveals early church history and doctrine, proving Roman Catholicism is not historically or doctrinally viable. MuslimHope.com. This site is a classic refutation of Islam, a counterfeit religion created by Muhammad. Free newsletters are also available.